Today, the Pain Game. Economic update, October 2025. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of these posts covering finance and property news. Well, each month I make a recording with Alex over at Nuggets News on the latest economic information, markets and housing. And this is my edit of our most recent show, which I think highlights some of the vagaries out there and some of the questions which perhaps we should be asking. Enjoy.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News or our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North. How are you, Martin?
I'm pretty good. How are you going?
I'm pretty good. Every month we say, I wonder what craziness is going to unfold the next few weeks, and we have the biggest crypto crash of all time, so we'll touch on that. But there's also plenty of huge world news unfolding.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I posed the question the other day with Tarek Brooker, who I make shows with, have we reached peak stupidity yet? And no, I don't think we have, but we're climbing the mountain.
Peak stupidity, but also I feel like there's more people waking up than ever to everything that's going on, which is fantastic. So, Absolutely. Yes. Let's dive into these slides, if you like.
Yeah, I think we should, because I think this sets it up quite nicely. And we should start with, obviously, the announcement late Friday in the US from Trump that he's ratcheting up the tariffs on China. China, of course, announced some changes, particularly around rare earths. We'll come on to a second. So the first slide is just showing the, you know, I hold all the cards, says Trump. No, you don't. The cards are made in China. And that's the point, really. You've got the biggest production engine in the world in China and the biggest customer in the US. So this is now going to get very interesting. Now, of course, markets reacted dramatically, as we'll touch on in a second. How real this is, bear in mind that looking to meet in a few weeks' time, probably. But this is a big deal. And it shows you, I think, that we are living in an unstable world where the question of trade and international relationships and all those things are actually up in the air. Now, kudos to Trump vis-a-vis the Middle East, at least for now. But this actually trade story is going to run and run. And if you go to the next slide, just to underscore, the rare earths is the cornerstone of the issue. And you can just see in this chart here, the dominance of China in terms of the rare earths. Rare earths, of course, are required to make the internet work and to make a lot of the AI stuff work and technology and defense. So China is holding the cards. And that's really the critical point to understand. And then go to the next slide. People are saying, well, this could actually pop the bubble, could shake up a lot of things. And markets, of course, reacted at the end of last week. And just quickly to go through the current state of play, the S&P 500 recovered somewhat, but it still was quite a long way down. The VIX is higher, the volatility index, the fear gauge is up at 20 now, which is higher than it's been. The NASDAQ dropped back a bit as well. In fact, some of the big stocks dropped quite considerably, but supported by AI. On the next slide, the 10-year yield has dropped a little bit down from where it was. So that's quite interesting. May suggest lower interest rates ahead. And gold futures, of course, still higher. Gold is the standout, plus silver, the next slide. So more and more people in, I'm sure you've seen the queues in Sydney, people trying to get gold and silver and trying to find a way out. I mean, this is all sort of quite concerning. And, my perspective on all this, Alex, is there are echoes to the 1929 crash here, where you've got a lot of bubbling, a lot of stupidity, a lot of volatility and instability. And I think this is the critical point that people need to understand. We are in very unstable times vis-a-vis the markets.
Yeah, I think a few thoughts I'd add was the US's economy is becoming more and more digitized and about surveillance and military and all this type of thing. And with a population of, 350 million people, that's just, I think, equating to less and less jobs. So they are going to be hit the hardest. And if they keep wanting those commodities, in particular things that are hard to get, like the rare earths you touched on, then they're not just going to be able to keep buying it with this fiat money they're printing out of thin air while they've got the world reserve status. And I think that's what were the real big change that can really affect markets. One of the reasons why gold and silver have been doing so well. And, we've been big fans of gold and silver for a long time. It's great to see it breaking out to record highs. But in nominal terms and inflation and them two other measures, I think silver could run further. And we saw the Perth Mint sold out. China just announced they're not going to be exporting any silver because they need it for electronics and stuff. So these are just wild, wild times that people were talking about years ago that this could happen someday. We're kind of on the precipice of all that now. But I still wonder how they're going to play this, if it's going to be an actual crash or it's just going to be a crash of the real economy for the average person while they're just going to pump, you know, the numbers on the screen in every single market continually higher and higher. So it's just a fascinating time to be alive.
Yeah, and if you jump forward one slide, the other interesting observation is the proportion of people invested in the US in the equity markets is now at an all-time high, 52% of US households. That's remarkable. And what it means is, of course, households are now directly exposed to these markets as well as indirectly through their pensions or savings. And I do think that this actually has a risk of severe instability. A lot of people are banking on the system continuing to support the growth of these values, despite the fact the ratios are very high, despite the fact that actually a lot of it's AI related and the AI story is being questioned. There are reports from the Bank of England, even from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, right, the IMF and other people saying, well, actually, some of these tech stocks look as though they're probably overvalued and, they might correct later. So we are in very bubbly territory. And the point I would want to make is that you can't rely on the central bank or the government to solve this for you. You know, we are in a situation where ordinary people are cannon fodder here. And that's the point I want to underscore. You know, ordinary people are going to actually find that it's going to get very nasty. And I think people need to just understand this is a bubble. The bubble is going to go nastily for many people. But of course, the few will be able to come out on top. And all the high speculation. And I then come to Bitcoin, which was, of course, the other thing that happened. Bitcoin dropped dramatically. Well, there were a few people who made lots of money in this crash of Bitcoin. Mm. And you and I both, Alex, would probably have surmised that there were some very well-informed people quite close to the White House who happened to do rather well.
Yeah, I mean, the other issue this cycle, which we've been talking about with our crypto research, is now there's just thousands and thousands of coins. The liquidity is already spread pretty thinly compared to, you know, the previous cycles. And so when you had this insider trading, the market makers pulling their liquidity, these whales putting on these positions right before Trump's tweet, it's all just very sus. And it also relates to that next slide you showed about US households 52 equity exposure. If you're the, you know, this government that wants to launch this control system and make people completely dependent on the state, if you pull the rug out of markets now, like the stocks or whatever, it's not the insiders and the CEOs that have been selling that are going to get hurt. It's these average people that are going to have to go onto welfare and that type of thing. So, yeah, it really is dangerous time. So, guys, yeah, take profits, pay down debt, have these assets that are outside the system. All this sort of advice we've been talking about for years, it's never been more important to actually put into place.
Yeah, and I think that issue about debt's really important because, as we'll see in a second or two, expectations of future interest rate movements are actually changing quite fast now. In fact, I don't know whether you saw, but Jerome Powell gave a speech at MABE yesterday. And in it, he was given an award for something. I don't know quite what, but I mean that cynically. But the fact of the matter is that he said, look, it's uncertain times. We've got higher inflation than we expected. We've got potentially higher unemployment than we've expected. We've got some issues of vagary because of the shutdown in the US and some of the publicly available data isn't now available. And so when they meet next time, it's going to be quite interesting to see what they do. They'll probably waffle around a bit and do nothing for a little while. But the fact of the matter is they cut rates last time. There was a very large dispersion in terms of the people around the table thinking about where rates may go, some thinking higher, some thinking lower. One member, of course, the one nominated by Trump, much lower. So we are in a situation where the central bank itself is relatively ineffective. They also, in his speech, made a specific comment about the liquidity pressures and the fact that the money market's actually at another pricing and the reverse repo prices are actually up a bit. So that's a very interesting indicator of potential pressure. And there's a couple of other sort of angles on this. The first is, if you go to the next slide, you can see here that we've got a lot of private equity and private credit sloshing around the place. And the credit system outside the major banks is now becoming a more and more significant issue, and is now becoming, well, it's not really regulated. So this is another black hole. And now people are starting to point to the private credit markets and the whole credit question. You know, is this sustainable, especially if interest rates don't come down further sooner? And then in terms of the data that's available, well, there is some data, but it's quite mixed. So, for example, the next slide, the US private employment report that came out fell. So, you know, how weak are US employment markets? What Powell said was that, well, roughly the employment demand and supply is moving in roughly the same amount, which means effectively that what we have is the unemployment rate roughly staying the same. But the indicators are that there's a bit of an issue there. But on the other hand, just to sort of set that in another context, the stock market cap to M2, in other words, the liquidity ratio, is as high as it's ever been. It's higher now, well, pretty much where it was in dot-com bubble time. So, there are so many indicators and conflicting indicators. And I don't think the Federal Reserve in the US has done a great job. I think central banks are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And as we'll see when it comes to Australia, even the central bank in Australia is also probably ineffective too. So, I mean, this is, again, coming right back to what you said. I think individuals need to be a little bit cautious. Don't over-leverage. Don't assume interest rates are going to get cut significantly. Don't assume that governments are going to intervene and support and help people. They probably won't. So you need to actually plow your own furrow.
Don't assume these people have any way out of this, I think, is the other thing, Martin.
Yeah. I mean, we are in a one-way spiral, and there is no way that they're going to reduce liquidity. Ultimately, liquidity has to continue to grow, because if liquidity was sucked out of the market, well, everything would crash. So that's the truth. And it doesn't matter whether it's the Treasury in the US pumping up liquidity or whether it's the central bank in the US pumping up liquidity. Liquidity will continue to grow. Same in Australia. The liquidity ratios are growing there. And of course, the private banks, well, they're part of the problem too, because they are continuing to create more credit out of thin air and put that credit into the system to pump house prices higher. Look at the way that the credit growth in Australia is double the rate of inflation. And that's really the point. So this is a one-way liquidity story until it finally pops. But the question is, how will it pop? When will it pop? And what will be the fallout?
Yeah, this next slide touches on what I was getting at before about just how digitized the US economy has become.
Well, this is a really interesting point. So we've got, over the last little while, we've had a huge set of announcements from the startup AI businesses who don't have a lot of revenue but have a lot of capability, doing deals with a lot of the big tech firms who have massive amounts of liquidity and money to burn, as it were, and also capacity. So basically, there's money going backwards and forwards, so that effectively we have more infrastructure being invested in and built to support the AI that is actually still being developed. Now, this is the biggest Ponzi scheme that I've seen for a long, long time, right? And everybody in the Broadcom was the last one. So there was an announcement over the last 24 hours. So Broadcom's now joined, Oracle's joined in. So almost everybody's chucking money left, right, and center. There's a massive amount of liquidity. And if you try and draw out the charts, the next one is just the Financial Times attempt to try and show all of the relationships and connections. I mean, this has the flavor to me of the global financial crisis in 2008, with all of the banks lending to each other and not wanting to open the packet and see what's inside, and the dot-com bubble in the year 2000, right, when we had massive amounts of infrastructure investment in dark fiber that never got lit for a long, long time, and a lot of telcos got into terrible trouble. There are so many signs here, so many parallels. And of course, everybody is saying, well, it's not a problem. These are entities that will generate huge amounts of revenue in the future. But the recent reports have suggested that, the investment in AI isn't necessarily so far paying back. So a lot of people are putting a lot of money into it and not getting a lot out. Now, that may change. And I do believe you're right that this digitalization process will continue and it's going to fundamentally change the way the economy works. But there is a lot of risk here that is not being fully supervised. And in fact, with the current administration in the US, of course, they want to encourage it rather than actually supervise it. And at the end of the day, you know, this is bubbling. The US economy is really bubbling because of this, this relationship between the AI providers and the tech providers, and the fact that these flows are going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. So it's a Ponzi scheme.
Well, it's not just that, Martin. When we look at that chart, I just want to highlight for people that all these big tech companies have now become so centralized. And we see, you know, Larry Ellison of Oracle just coming out and going, I'm going to buy TikTok because I don't like the sentiment and the information that is getting out there from the next generation. We need to control the narrative. And then you've got all these, you know, Israeli intelligence firms and other intelligence agencies that have got these private contracts, you know, with government. It's all just this becoming, we're one step away from this complete, you know, new world order, AI running everything that we need to avoid at all costs. And it's just wild to see that these things can happen, these chess moves like that. I'm just going to buy the most influential platform and take it over and start to censor things. It's crazy times.
Yeah. And these large corporations, of course, which are actually above individual countries and have their own internal logic about what they want to do, are competing with each other to an extent, but actually what they're doing is effectively monetizing everybody's information. They're monetizing all of the you know, the stuff in the system, as it were, and copyright is being thrown out the window and all those things. And at the end of the day, this is a future where things like digital ID and all the other stuff that we talk about, just overlay that over the top. And basically, if you're not in this new high-tech world and paying your dues to these large corporations, you will be disenfranchised.
Okay, moving on. So to the UK.
Yeah, I want to pick up the UK because the IMF came out with a report and said that the UK's growth rate will be the second strongest in Europe over the next 12 months, and was sort of saying, well, it's not bad. But when you look at the data, the real wages growth in the UK has evaporated, which is quite interesting. You can also see here that the pay is slowing faster than expected. And interestingly, public sector wages growth is a little bit stronger than private sector wages growth. And then on the other one, you can see the very importantly, the jobless rate, particularly for young people, is actually rising. Now, those are very good analogies for what's happening in Australia too. The data is yet to sort of come out in Australia, but I'm seeing similar things. So I'm seeing real wages growth evaporating in Australia. I'm seeing the public sector wages growth a little bit stronger, but private sector wages growth dropping significantly, and people are now going backwards again. And very importantly, the unemployment rate amongst youngsters in Australia is also rising. So these are very important indicators to once again show that the economy is not in good nick.
Yeah. I'll have a bit more of a rant, Martin, when we get to the Australian data, but I'll let you talk about this one here.
Yeah. So now I ran a show the other day talking about households, how real households are coping with the property pickle despite the hype. Now, there's a lot of hype going on in Australia and elsewhere, but in Australia. So the Reserve Bank came out and said, well, households are doing quite well. You know, they're actually spending more and their incomes are growing, you know, in real terms, et cetera. So no, they're not. And then, of course, we've got the 5% deposit for first-time buyers, which will allow more people to get into the market. And everyone's talking about house prices bubbling higher. Well, just be clear, folks, on a comparable basis, Australia is leading the pack when it comes to rises of global house prices from January 1990. So the last thing we want is yet more house price growth. But guess what? On the next slide, according to Totality, yep, prices are up. Not uniformly to the same extent, but pretty much everywhere in the past month, we saw some rises. Hobart, the lowest, 0.1. Perth, 1.6%. Darwin, 1.7%. Brisbane, 1.2%. And this is pretty disastrous. Look over the last 12 months. Darwin up 12%. We've got Adelaide up 6.2%. Perth, 7.5% of the last 12 months. This is way faster than income growth. So this is not good. And if you go to the next slide, it's also the rental sector, which is also being hit. Guess what? Rental growth is now up again, rising 4.3% over the year. And very importantly, almost all centres are seeing strong rental growth. And by the way, that also means on the next slide, if you look at the gross rental yields, because dwelling values have moved up more than rental values, investors are actually seeing their gross rental yields over time reducing. And of course, gross rental yields are only partially the story. If you look at net yields, which is what I do, which is the difference between the rental that you can get and the costs of the property that you're actually managing if you're an investor, more and more underwater, more than half are underwater. So this is another example of quite a lot of stupidity. And we're going to see more of this, but you know, the spruiking is at one end of the spectrum. Reality is somewhere very different. And I'm afraid that our politicians and our central bank are actually part of the spruik.
Yeah, and here we can see, I think we've shown this one before, but just these are just crazy numbers.
Yeah, so the average income, you know, this is one we've quite often come back to, $293,000 in Sydney to get a house, right? That's a lot of money. That means two incomes always now, not just one, almost predominantly. And all across the country, housing is unaffordable. And just a couple of other data points, new construction costs continue to go up. Comparing it with wages growth. So effectively what that means is that the builds of new property is continuing to be unaffordable. And that probably helps to explain the next slide, which is why dwelling completions continue to fall. So we are having a supply issue where there is not enough property to meet the high demand that we've got. We've got prices continue to rise, and governments and the central bank are doing things that effectively are pushing those home prices even higher. So no surprise, on the next slide, look at my stress data. Well, we've still got half of households with a mortgage in financial flow pressure. And we've got 74.6% of renters. The rental sector is where a lot of the pressure is. And again, I come back to this fact. There is not enough focus in the media in Australia about those in the rental sector and the pressures that they're under. They just don't get enough coverage. Everybody's talking about the mortgage holder and, you know, how interest rates are going to come down and how people can borrow more, and the banks are trying to reduce the buffers so that they can lend even more. The story here is we've got more than a third of households in the rental sector, of which around three quarters are having difficulty making those rental payments. This is a national disaster.
And these are just stunning figures when we talk about COVID being an important, you know, piece for them to start pushing the Great Reset and all this type of thing. Just how we went from, you know, around 20% there in 2017, even here, not too bad, just before COVID. You know, these are staggering figures, the amount of people that are under rental and mortgage stress. But I wonder, the other thing we've seen is the report out of Victoria, 9 out of 10 jobs are now, you know, public sector government job. So does this matter if everyone's on welfare or on the government payroll? We know that taxpayers mathematically can't foot this bill. So I just wonder how this all plays out. It's just insane. But the government can't just keep paying for everything forever. The Australian dollar would ultimately be the one to suffer. And the thing that gets me is Aussies have just had it so good for so long. We avoided the GFC. People just don't have this mindset that anything bad could ever happen. And you look at the streets of these American cities or Greece, even countries that have plenty of resources that went into hyperinflation have just seen this civil unrest and crime that degrading in that fabric of society. And I've been talking about Melbourne's definitely going to be the first one to go, and all those signs are there and picking up. It's just crazy to watch this unfold in slow motion as a deliberate plan by those in charge. And I think that's what people are cluing into now, that no one sits around and thinks, oh, this is a good idea to import this many people while there's this housing crisis. Or it's just crazy watching them deliberately destroy this country.
Yeah, and I think that point is right. Deliberate, it's an intentional thing. And it's because they're measuring success through the lens of a GDP top line number, not per capita, which of course has been going backwards, but the total volume of transactions through the economy, as it were. But that doesn't necessarily do well for ordinary people. And you're dead right. So compared with pre-COVID, we're in a whole new world. The government debt is continuing to rise. The cost of debt's continuing to rise too. The tax take is higher than it's ever been and will continue to rise. And all of those factors mean that ordinary people are finding it harder and harder. And that's why I sort of wanted to press in on talk about real households and what their experience is, not what the top-down economists are saying is going on, because the top-down economists have no idea, right? Mm. They are relying on out-of-date data from HILDA, which is 2 or 3 years old. They're relying on partial information from mortgage-backed security pools, which is a very hand-picked selection of mortgages. This is very different from the real world of many households. And yet, when I talk to people, they're really quite desperate now to try and work out how to solve this for themselves, because they begin to realize that the government's not going to solve it. They're just going to pump this more and more and more. And if you want an example of the pump, go to the next slide. So this is, of course, the 5% deposit scheme for first-time buyers. This is the new thing that came in 1 October. Well, guess what? The RBA says that this is going to push prices higher. Now, Treasury said 0.6% over 6 years or something, very small amount. But there are a lot of people who are suggesting that over the first 12 months, this could put prices up 5 to 10% in that sector of the market, which I think is very important. And there's lots of articles, of course, spruiking this and saying, you know, buy, buy, buy. You know, and a lot of first-time buyers trying to actually be encouraged to go into the market. Just to on the next slide, be careful, though, of course, because there's still a serviceability question here. So you may actually be able to borrow with a 5% deposit now if you're a first-time buyer and meet the criteria, but you still have to be able to afford to repay the 95% mortgage. And that means that the payments each month will be more because, of course, it's a bigger loan. And just bear in mind that the banks, to some extent, are still recording these as higher-risk mortgages, which means that the interest rate you may be able to get is often higher than if you've got a bigger deposit. And that's the other part of the story that people aren't being told. And if prices do adjust down for any reason, then, of course, you lose that 5% very quickly and easily. So there's a real big Ponzi angle here too. The government is pumping, trying to keep the housing market bubbling higher and higher and higher. They gave a commitment before the election that prices will continue to rise. Remember that? Well, guess what? They are. But this is not good for Australia, and it's not good for Australians.
And just like we spoke about with the stock market in the US with average households' exposure to equities, if they're going to pull the rug and there is another financial crash coming, you know, all these people that are rushing in to get this 5% scheme, as you say, I haven't heard much rhetoric around what is going to happen if there's a 5 to 10% correction, which is completely normal. Hmm. What are they going to do? Are all these people, again, going to be dependent on the government for welfare then?
Well, of course they will. And by the way, the taxpayer will be on the hook for the gap, right, if in fact things go wrong. That's another point. So more and more of the economy is being supported by taxpayers. A greater share of the overall economy is thanks to the tax take from households, not corporates. Corporates are actually still skinnying down their tax contributions. It's actually households. And yeah, we are in a quasi-UBI, government pay, government control world, despite the fact that, you know, no one wants to admit it. And if governments turn off the tap of their investment into the public sector, the economy will crash. So they've got to keep this thing going. They've got to keep the property Ponzi going. All of those things, there's no way to solve this other than to keep the can kicking it down the road, keeping the balls in the air and hoping that, you know, it's not going to go wrong on my watch. That's what we've got.
Yeah. Okay. Next up, consumer confidence.
Yeah. And I want to highlight, consumer confidence is now slumped. It's 12 months lower. This is according to the latest ANZ Roy Morgan. And people are beginning to see through this. That's my point. People are beginning to wake up to the fact that things are not right. And so there is perhaps a greater uneasiness about their personal situation. There's more concern about the reaction to the fact that rates may not come down. And we'll come onto that in a second. And all of those things now are really bubbling up to the surface. I see this in my surveys too. Oh, and by the way, the RBA on the next slide went on to say, don't blame us for the house prices growth. It's nothing to do with us. You know, it's nothing to do with anything that we've done. refusing to comment on whether changes to capital gains tax concessions would reduce housing demand. And as I said, prices are high. The RBA is washing their hands of this, nothing to do with us. No, they're part of the problem. They created this as part of their story from 2008 and through COVID. But no, the RBA says nothing to do with us. Shame on them.
Yeah, just like they said, printing trillions during COVID and handing it out wouldn't cause inflation. Just you've got to do the opposite to what these people say.
Now, I made a show with John Wright, who's an associate professor, and if you haven't seen it, it's worth watching. He actually pulls apart this whole property issue, and he highlights that actually the property market is effectively a real estate carry trade, which basically is a way of you get over here and you take it over there and then you do something different with it, right? And he's basically saying the investment markets and the way these are set up in Australia are almost unique, with the CGT benefits and the capital, you know, the capital gains and everything else and the other tax breaks. And he basically says this is going to go on and on and on until ultimately it will fold in on itself. And he actually uses the analogy of the real estate industry is effectively it's the Death Star, right? But then he actually makes some suggestions about what we can do to actually begin to unpick it. But, you know, if you want a provocative and thoughtful piece on what's really going on with property, I do recommend the John Wright show, which was published over the weekend. It's got a very good run.
Yeah, and it's not like people like yourself haven't been warning about this for years, Martin, and you know, they've pulled every lever, including we said the last one was going to be immigration. And here we are. But nobody wanted to hear it because everyone in Australia loves property and they want their house price to go up. But the price, there's always a price to pay, and now it's societal collapse.
Absolutely. It is unfortunately now getting, you know, quite serious. And by the way, just on the migration, you mentioned the latest data came out. Now, this is the net permanent and long-term arrivals data. It's not the migration data. To be clear, the ABS wants to make a distinction between the two. But as Tarek here shows, for the year to August, net long-term and permanent arrivals into Australia were at the highest level ever. Now, that's just worth thinking about right now. We'll get some migration data eventually, which will be sort of sanitized and what have you, but that's not good. Now, interestingly, in New Zealand, where migration was high and then they dialed it back, guess what? The Kiwis got a 0.5% rate cut over the last week, and the economy is stalling there. Home prices are falling in New Zealand. And so if you take a migration away, guess what happens? The economy begins to actually change and housing begins to drop, and make it a little more affordable to get into the New Zealand housing market. And by the way, rents in New Zealand, on the next slide, are also down. So if you don't believe there's a connection between migration and high migration and home prices, just look at New Zealand or look at Canada. Because in both situations where they dialed back migration, things changed. Prices started to fall and rents started to fall. So there is a very strong observational connection between the two, and it's logical if you think about supply and demand. So it is worth just understanding the high migration strategy that this government and the previous government ran. It's deliberate strategy, but it's not actually getting us to a good place, and unfortunately it's putting more pressure on infrastructure, more pressure on housing, more pressures on rents. And yet we should be having a really hard conversation about this, but neither side of politics really wants to tackle it.
Well, the thing that stands out to me, Martin, is Wellington, you know, the cities that have dropped the most, and then areas like Otago, if that's how you pronounce it, these more rural areas where people are choosing that lifestyle of getting out of cities and going somewhere more rural. So I think that's a trend we're going to see massively in Australia, people leaving Melbourne.
Yeah, well, I think we're already seeing Melbourne is, as you said, a basket case, and more people are still trying to sell and get out, property investors in particular, just trying to get out. And they are actually looking to try and sell to those first-time buyers who might be interested in buying some of those properties with that 5% deposit so they can get out, right? That's a very, very important point. Now, the Reserve Bank minutes came out. This is from the meeting of the 29th, 30th. I just want to highlight a couple of things. They're saying, well, there's nothing to see here in terms of high loan-to-value loan. It's not really a problem. And they talked about APRA and APRA doing things. Remember that the banks are trying to persuade APRA to reduce the buffer, that lending buffer, so they can lend more. I got a strong read from these minutes that that's unlikely to happen, because the Reserve Bank is watching this and they warned specifically about the risk to the housing market. And they also made an interesting point about some of their modelling is rather imprecise and are not sure about what the neutral rate is. So, you know, I don't think the RBA's modelling and predictions and expectations are that great. But if you go to the next slide, what you can see here is that now people are saying possibly no interest rate cuts for upward of 9 months, according to NAB. And that's really quite fascinating. And the question will be, well, will the labour market really weaken or won't it? And if the labour market doesn't really weaken and just muddles along sideways, and we have stronger inflation, which is what we've now got in Australia, inflation's going up, not down, the likelihood is rates will stay higher than people were expecting. They won't come down any further. That's going to put more pressure on households. It's also meaning that those people with that 5% deposit hook, they've got to think about what happens if rates don't get cut any further. And that's a big deal.
Yeah, that's probably one scenario we haven't explored a heap. We might do in a future episode or our predictions for the next year video at the end of the year, is that if inflation just gets completely out of hand with this everything bubble, particularly in Aussie dollar terms, if it's losing its purchasing power versus the US dollar, what are these people going to do if we would have anything like the 90s to interest rates to get up towards, say, 10% or something like that, where they had to get inflation under control? That's something we should explore more in.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, and remember that the long-term median interest rate's about 7-point-something percent, right? That's if you go back 100 years or so, that's 7%. So we are still in low territory relative to history. So it's worth bearing in mind. Mm-hmm. Now, as we come to the end of the show, just a couple of little takeouts here. The big one, of course, this week was Chalmers backpedaling on the superannuation thing. This was pretty amazing. Of course, there was a lot of pushback to the idea of taxing unrealized gains within superannuation. And I always said, well, if they get it in for superannuation, then they'll spread it to property and other asset classes too. So I'm pleased to announce that they backpedaled. Chalmers had to stand up and say, well, we've rethought about it, whilst Albo was away on holiday, which I thought the timing was quite interesting, right? And on the next slide, you can see here, this is from Phil Curry, who said that he thinks the PM's paw prints are all over the super back down, and essentially Chalmers was forced to backpedal. And this one from the AFR showing, what's happened to your pants, Jim? They've been indexed, right? So now we've got indexing on the three million superannuation balances, another higher level at 10 million with a higher tax take as well, but also some messing around at the lower end, which is right for some of those young people and low-income earners who actually were being taxed much higher. But the fundamental principle of the issue of taxing unrealized gains off the table, which is a good piece of news. So now, of course, the question is, will it actually go up? Will the Greens push back on it? So we'll watch that. That's going to be the continued balance going forward, but I think it's important. And the very last slide, just to leave you with a thought, country could shut down. Australia's just 28 days of petrol. Another disaster looming. We don't do much at home now when it comes to refining. We are completely exposed now to what happens internationally. And in the current environment, with all this international uncertainty, the trade tariffs and everything else, and all of that global stuff going on, this is not good for Australia either. So wherever you look, there are issues, right? And folks, prepare for a bumpy ride as we come into 2026.
Yeah, on that resource dwindling, we're not making any friends by being the first ones to push digital ID the hardest, and Trump saying, I don't like that, or, who knows what Russia and China are going to turn around and do, and go, Australia all of a sudden is that person that no one wants to deal with, and we're selling all our resources are foreign owned. Imagine this situation where we can't get petrol or gas, but we've got plenty of it just because of how sold out the country's become. It's just wild.
Yeah, wild, poorly governed, and unfortunately the politicians don't seem to care.
Well, guys, the links to Martin's channel, to watch those videos he mentioned and all his content down below, and all my socials and our research and that down below as well. Martin, thank you, and we'll chat again next month.
Look forward to it. Take care.